In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about updates on Bluetick, Drip, and other madness. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 339. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
Well, I am back to feeling really good about Drip because for the last maybe month prior to last week, which I talked a little bit about it, we just had, you know, scaling issues, right? It's like stuff comes up and you don't know if it's a database. You don't know if you can add more horsepower to it. Code implementation, you know, what it is. So different times a day, certain queues would back up and it's like, we're shipping a lot of features. Like the team is kind of firing on all cylinders right now. And I feel like we're probably the most productive we've been in ages, perhaps ever. I mean, just given that the team size is so much larger, we're able to just ship stuff faster. And yet, like every week was ruined for me because there would be these delays or, you know, whatever, this page load slower, just whatever that like makes me feel like, you know, we aren't living up to the promises that we make to our customers. But we are we turned like a big corner last week with it. And I feel great about everything. So that's my week.
Yeah, I know what you're saying about, like, I think the best analogy that I might have heard this someplace, but I kind of feel like I thought of it on my own at one point was like when you're working on a SaaS app, like everything is in motion while you're working on it. So it's almost like being a heart surgeon. Like you have to make sure that everything stays up and running while you're still working on it.
Totally. That's right. I mean, Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, said building a startup is like jumping out of an airplane and then assembling the parachute on the way down, right? Because you're kind of in free fall and you're burning through cash. And the analogy works really well for running a SaaS app and having to do kind of performance improvements, refactors, you know, anything like that that impacts a lot of things. And this is where unit testing comes, is such a nice scaffold, right? Unit testing is like having good test coverage. It's kind of like jumping out with the, you know, the parachute's already half made, or, you know, maybe the parachute. I'll just stop there because that was a really dumb analogy anyway. So
I was going to point out, I wasn't sure where you're going to go.
You're
with
like,
that.
Dude, you're taking this really too far. Let's ditch the parachute thing.
That's almost like my analogy against the heart surgeon.
Yeah, exactly. How about you? What's going on this week?
Well, minor champagne moment. I've recently crossed the $1,000 a month MRR with Bluetick. So things are going in the right direction. Of course, because it's the beginning of the month, like you look at the statistics for growth and stuff like that, and they're just tanked at the bottom just because it's the beginning of the month instead of the end. But
I know you got pre-orders, you know, up front, but this is actively like active customers, right? These are people that are actually using it, not people who have paid you and are planning to use it.
Yes, these are people that have paid me and are currently using it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, most of the people that I had on who had come in as pre-orders and then converted over into paying customers, a lot of them had, I essentially applied credits to their account to give them credit for that pre-order to some extent, kind of mostly to kind of boost them over from being a pre-order and kind of having an indefinite beta period over to like being a paid customer. And those payments are going to be starting to kick in this month. But even with all that, like it's still over $1,000 a month. And my goal for this month is to double it, but we'll see how that goes.
Wahoo, $1,000 a month, man.
Yep.
You going to Disneyland? You going to go out and buy a new car?
No, I had a beer last night. That was
That was your champagne moment, was to drink a beer?
Yeah, champagne, beer. You know, I'm sure somebody's going to have a coronary over that analogy.
Nice. Do you feel like the pace is picking up in terms of how quickly you're adding customers?
It is. And that's both intentional, but also as a byproduct of people talking about it because they are using it and they're having good experiences. So they're turning around and referring other people to it and saying, hey, you know, I've been using this and it's been working really well for me. That and coupled with like some of my outreach efforts of just either doing on podcasts or talking to people who are on my mailing list. It's a combination of things, but yeah, I'm definitely pursuing things a lot more in that regard as well. And it's unfortunately a juggling act too, because like there's things that come in and people say, hey, can it do this or can this be modified? You know, can we add a feature or function over here that does X, Y, or Z? And it's prioritizing those against all the other things that are going on is really pretty hard.
Yeah, that's how it always is, right? There's always, especially in the early days, man, it's tough. That's why starting on your own and really being the single founder is such a hard road to go. If you're going to build an app like this that's not in a small niche market where you can move slow and there's no competition and you can kind of trudge along, building something like this where there's competition and you're going to have to be keeping up, you need to get to the place where you have enough revenue to basically hire somebody soon. And essentially, you know, Jason Calcanis says, hire your co-founders, right? That's what he does now. He doesn't have co-founders, but he hires people really early because he raises a round and he has a little bit he can back it with, and he's able to give out less equity, but he brings people on very early. You don't see him building something solo early on because there's just too much to do when you're launching something that you want to see, you know, grow pretty quickly and it's in a big market.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely things that are kind of falling on the floor right now. I mean, one thing that's been sitting on my to-do list for well over like a couple of months at this point has been working on the sales website. And even people who come through the sales funnel and I start talking to them, the biggest chunk of questions that they have is kind of what does this actually do? Because this, the website doesn't explain it very well. And really the website is just one page. So there's not a whole lot of explaining that it really can do on that one page. It doesn't provide use cases or examples or screenshots really. I mean, there's very little there to go off of. Most people are really relying on what they've been told by other people or what they've heard about either from me or from other places where I've done like a podcast interview or something like that.
You know, it's really cool when you say that some of your new customers are coming from other people using it. Like that was word of mouth was a big driver in the early days of Drip. Not as much with Hittail, but there was some. But if you have that already, like if you have that when you only have low double-digit number of customers, that's a good sign, right? It's a really good sign because as you grow, that's just a snowball that allows you to continue kind of leveling up. And when you add 100 or 1,000, if you still get that same percentage of people, it'll always be lower, right, as time goes on. But if you can get folks talking about it, it's a really nice way to be involved in every conversation, right? You always want people to say, remember how like Infusionsoft and Ontraport, it was always the two of them. And just by nature of that fact, Ontraport, which is nowhere near the product that Infusionsoft is, you know, had all this growth. And then I remember when Drip started to be part of those conversations, when they would say, oh, Infusionsoft or Drip or Ontraport, you know, and it like I would see it. Obviously, it's not in every conversation about it, but I would see it in these online forums, these threads, and they'd get thrown out. And I remember when that started happening, and it was game changing because you just become another viable option rather than a tool that no one has heard about.
Yeah, one of the things that I do, I think it's one of the first questions that I ask in the survey when you go to Bluetick's website and ask for an invitation code. One of the questions in there is, where did you hear about this? So I'm finding out exactly who people heard about the product from, which is, it's nice to be able to track it back to people who either placed pre-orders or are current customers. I even have one customer who is, like has a bunch of customers that he works with, and he's going to start recommending it to them because he's had such a good experience with it, and they wanted to use it internally first, and things have gone well in that respect. So now they're turning around and they're going to back to their customer base, say, hey, let's get you onboarded with this so that we can help you more. So what about you? What else is new?
Well, you know, as I talk about most weeks, most of my updates involve scaling Drip and hiring people, right? That's kind of a big focus of mine now. There is some other stuff. I might get into it later, depending on how much time we have today. But I feel, you know, we've been pretty consistently we've had an open job, at least one job opening since we got acquired. And most times we have either two or three. So we're constantly hiring either new, like front end, like UI, UX, new Rails folks or new people to help with scaling. And I feel like I'm kind of in the groove of hiring at this point. I've gotten pretty good. You know, it's kind of this skill that you go in and out of, because when you're not hiring, you forget like how to skim through a resume really quick, how to do a quick phone interview, how to do a quick in-person interview. But we've just been doing so many recently that I feel like I'm kind of in the groove of it, which I don't know that I necessarily want to be. Hiring people is not an aspiration of mine. Like I think as we've always talked about, like, you know, my book Start Small, Stay Small, the small was about headcount, not about revenue, right? I always want to grow revenue. But it's like, I want to keep headcount down. But in this case, it's even just looking ahead, you know, as we're Xing, 2Xing, 3Xing every so often, it's pretty frequent that we're just doubling our customer base. We just have to hire a little bit ahead of where we actually are, as well as, you know, like I said earlier, being in a competitive space, we need to continue delivering features, which as we talked about in the past, is harder and harder to do, like the bigger you get, because you spend so much time just maintaining what you already have, right? Making sure the database is ahead of everybody's need and the code base and the queues and, you know, just all the stuff that you're running. So yeah, I guess to summarize, we've been hiring a lot. I'm hoping we can slow down here pretty soon. We found some really good candidates, and I guess it's getting in the groove of it. I do like doing a bunch of hiring and then stopping so that I don't have to constantly, you know, be doing it and can kind of focus on other things.
So is that going to be the focus of your next book, is how to hire people at scale?
Oh my gosh. Seriously? No. No, it will definitely not. And like I say, it's super cool when you get a new person on board and you get them up to speed and they start contributing. And it's like Derek and I looked at each other and we're like, we're shipping a lot of features. And it's because there's all these people, you know, doing things that used to be in either in our lap, or we just pull, you know, hey, we have a scaling issue. So we'd pull one developer off of something. And now we don't have to, like, we have dedicated people who that's all they're doing. And so we've, you know, like I keep saying, like, we've hit our stride. I hate, you know, to keep using that analogy, but it really does feel like we're getting the right people in the right roles. And it's kind of a good feeling when you do slot somebody in and then you see them start shipping things and you're like, man, I'm really proud of what we're putting out, even though we're not doing all the work anymore. Because you think back when you're like crafting the software, you're crafting the UI, or, you know, and with Drip, that was really all Derek, right? I mean, it was he and I deciding what to build and me handling everything else. But for so long, it was just all bottlenecked by one or two people's bandwidth. But now with, you know, with a growing team, it's neat to see that we're able to maintain the efficiency and still continue. That hiring more people actually means we can push out more software, right? Rather than in other companies I've worked at where hiring more people actually makes things worse, you know, it like slows everybody down.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. Do you find that as you are adding more features, that like the individual features that you're adding tend to be more invasive, like throughout the entire course of the app? So it's not like a little surface thing that you can toggle here or add over there. It's like you're adding this feature that needs to be added throughout like a large part of the pipeline of the application.
You know, that doesn't come up too much, to be honest. I think in the early days it did, because, you know, you're just trying to get to that point where you've built something that people want. And I think these days with our product is just so much more mature that there are things we add now and again that impact everything. But our architecture is really solid, so things are broken out into their own, you know, subsystems and such. While there certainly are some that come through, for the most part, a lot of these things tend to be more self-contained, I'll say. I mean, it may impact 5 files or, you know, worst case, 10 files, and you have to go through all these layers of something. And those are the ones that get a little scary, right? Because you really got to make sure you have unit test coverage like crazy on that. But yeah, I would imagine you're probably in that boat though, right? Where kind of everything you add, it's like, oh gosh, I have to go re-architect this thing in order to do it.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I was asking, because I find that a lot of the changes that I'm making tend to be stuff that have to be tracked down or you know, tracked all the way through from the front end, all the way through the API, and then into the service layer and the security layer, and then into the database. And it gets to be, I don't want to say frustrating, but it takes a lot longer to get some of those things done than I would like, especially because of all the maintenance and ongoing, you know, like either requests or bug fixes and things like that. There's just like tweaks and adjustments that kind of invade into that space while I'm trying to get those things done. It's just honestly, like, the juggling act right now is really pretty hard. So I was just kind of curious, like, whether or not you still ran into those types of things. So maybe there's light at the end of the tunnel for me.
Yeah, there is, but it takes a while. I remember we refactored Drip, like major database refactor, probably twice before we got to launch, right? So Derek broke ground on code December of 2012, and we really launched to the world in November of 2013. But we had kind of our first group of, you know, 10, 20 customers coming on as early as June of 2013. So that was 7 months in. And I think within that first 6 months before we really had people, he had to do a massive rip apart of some things that we had just made decision to couple and they shouldn't have been coupled. And then there was another one when we launched automation, right? So that was early 2014 as he was building automation. That was just painful. It was like 2 months of standing still. And then he built automation. That once he had it done, the automation stuff was actually not so hard to build, but it was just like, we have to separate these two database tables in a, you know, as you're falling down, making your parachute. And yeah, it was gnarly. But after that, like once we hit there, we've had limited need to do that, because I think the building blocks got in place and the product was solidified, right? Now it's marketing automation, and we're not going to add on shopping cart, landing page, affiliate marketing management, you know, whatever else. That would all, I think, impact some of this other stuff. Whereas you're still figuring out, like, where I would guess at your stage, we were still figuring out, I should say. So really trying to figure out, like, should I build this feature? What is this product going to become? What is the vision for the product? And is my vision still aligning with what the market's asking for? And that makes things very fluid, I think is probably a good word for it.
Yeah, I'm having the same types of general conversations with most people when it comes to either features that they want implemented, like the roadmap that I have in my head, that it's obviously different than I originally started out with, but over the past several months, it really hasn't changed a lot. And most of my time is spent trying to get those things done. So that's more the challenge, is not that trying to figure out what to do, it's figuring out what order to do it in and how to get it out as quickly as possible without wrecking things along the way. Because as you said, like there's that issue where if you go to roll out a new feature or a new piece of the code, if it touches a bunch of different pieces of the application and you don't have as many unit tests around it as you would like, then it's a little scary to hit that deploy button. So most of the time, what I do is I deploy it out to my development server and then I just try to beat on it a little bit to see, like, can I break this? Or are there any obvious things that I might have missed that may not be covered by unit tests? Because the front end of the UI, like there's very little unit tests around the front end stuff, like the services and all the back end stuff. Like there's unit tests there, but the front end is not tested well. But that's also because I know that the front end is changing a lot. So it's much harder to put something in place where I'm just going to have to change all those things anyway.
Right. And you know, the front end unit testing, which I guess now becomes what, integration or system testing? There's like a different name for it when you're going all the way from the top down. That's the front end super slow, right? And so, and it, I consider it a more advanced method of testing. Not a bad thing to have for some critical paths, I think. It's just my opinion. Others may disagree with me. But it's like your signup flow, yeah, you should probably have, it'd be nice to have a nice UI test for that and maybe sending a broadcast, you know, in the sense of an email marketing. I mean, it's your basic fundamental things. But A, I would not be testing settings pages or like little corners of the app a lot of people don't use. And B, I've heard of folks who separate those front end unit tests that hit the UI into a completely different test suite because they can take 30 minutes to run or an hour to run because they are so slow because they have to spin up browser instances and click on things. So I don't know. I would say at this point, you will be better off annually QAing your stuff and then just having unit tests below the surface. That's probably where what I would head. I don't think I would spend a bunch of time doing UI tests yet. I actually don't think the UI testing suites are that still. They're still not that great.
Oh, they're terrible.
I know. I was using Selenium in like 2008, maybe 2007 to 2009 in there to test .NET Invoice. And it was horrendous. And I've heard there's like another layer now built on top of Selenium. And I heard it's still not that great.
Yeah, I poked around at it a little bit, but realized that there was just too many things changing to really make any sort of difference. And it wasn't worth going down that road. So, I mean, the API and stuff gets tested and some of the different layers. But, you know, once it's past that, I mean, the front end of the app, it's all this massive JavaScript application because it's all written in Angular. So there's not much there other than the smoke testing that, you know, if I make a change on the front end UI, you know, I can be reasonably assured that the APIs and stuff underneath are working, but that's no guarantee that if you click on a button, it's still going to do what it's supposed to do.
For sure. And that's where I think about having code that doesn't have a bunch of side effects on other places. And so if you're working in a certain part of the code, you know that you don't have to go test all these other pages, right? That you can test this one thing and be fairly confident that you're not going to break something in the UI and then do a cursory test as you deploy it. And then just let your customers find your bugs. No, I'm only kidding. It's like the worst. I know of some of our competitors do that and it has tarnished their reputation.
Yeah, if I can find and fix a bug before the customer ever sees it or knows that it was an issue, then that's probably the ideal scenario. But but it's still hard. I mean, I'm just constrained on resources and time. And speaking of time, things have gotten even worse for me because as of 3 days ago, my wife acquired a larger fitness studio here in town. So commence schedule craziness at this point. And it's just her schedule is all over the place. And obviously, like, mine is pretty swamped as it is. So just kind of trying to overlap enough so that we make sure that the kids are taken care of and dinner's ready and all the other stuff that needs to be taken care of is done and out of the way is really been super challenging the past couple of days.
Two people running businesses in the house, that is yeah, tough. I can imagine that. No, that's really complicated, man. Yeah, having flexible schedules sounds great until you realize that you have to, like, two people with flexible schedules is chaos. Like Sherry and I have run into that in the past where it's like, I think I have a flexible schedule, but like you said, you actually have kids and you have like some other responsibilities to get kids picked up and get dinner made and this kind of stuff. So I totally get it.
Plus, our youngest was sick yesterday. So it was either yesterday or the day before. One of those days this week, he ended up staying home from school. And then last night, he had a fever, and we thought he was going to be home again from school today. And it turned out he was fine. But, you know, it's just, it's hard to juggle all that stuff. And plus, with her new business, I mean, she's, you know, it's a larger business. So she's got multiple contractors that she didn't have before. And, you know, there's scheduling issues and moving to a new space and new software and all this other stuff that goes with it. So there's a pretty large learning curve is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I bet, man. Well, good for her. Big congratulations to the both of you, I guess, for, you know, her acquiring that studio sounds kind of cool. I bet that's a good move for her to kind of up her game. She's leveling up, stair-stepping up, if you will. Boom.
Yep, yep.
How involved are you in her business?
You know, I helped look at like the business financials and stuff early on, but beyond that stuff and just kind of verifying like, hey, is this a good move to make? I really tried to kind of stay out of it, just kind of pointed out, here's something you might run into, or here's something else that could be an issue, or just don't worry about this over here, but trying to kind of stay away from it. I mean, that's kind of her thing. So I'm not trying to get in the way. It's really what it comes down to, trying to stay out of the way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So speaking of all the scheduling madness and how to juggle that, Sherry and I made the decision early in the year. Actually, we were talking to someone who said they had an au pair, and an au pair is someone, is typically a young woman who comes from overseas and wants to come to America and basically is like a live-in nanny. And so we were talking to someone who had an au pair and said it was like life-changing and it was the best decision ever and all that stuff. So I started noodling on it, and we realized that we were both going to MicroConf, and I was going to be gone for a week or 6 days, and Sherry was going to be gone for 4 or 5. And every time we'd go away for overnights, it's expensive, really expensive to hire folks to, you know, hire someone to watch your kids overnight. And then there's always, they don't know your routine and they don't know your house. And, you know, there's just all so much to communicate that it's like super stressful. And so we were like, let's hire a live-in nanny. Like, let's see if we can find essentially a local au pair, you know, someone who, Sherry was like, a young college student would be perfect, right? And so we did. And I interviewed, I don't even know, a dozen people here in Minneapolis, and right before MicroConf, like the week before, she moved in. And so she lives in, you know, we have like a basement living suite. It has everything except for a kitchen, right? So it has a full bath or a three-quarter bath, and then it has laundry and a bedroom, and then we share the kitchen. But it has been game-changing, man, and for exactly the reason you said, is like, sometimes Sherry and I just are 30 minutes off, you know, where we're not going to be there and the kids are going to be there. Or sometimes we need to be in two places at once. Or there's just, you know, Sherry goes out of town. She went out of town for 4 or 5 days to Austin for yoga, some training in aerial yoga. And it's like, during that time, I can handle the kids, but like, they get on the bus at 9:15 in the morning. And so that, you know, would put me at work at 9:40. And now it's not like you even need to be around that much to watch the kids because they're both in school, but I can leave at, you know, 8:30 or whatever, and someone's kind of just hanging out with them for 45 minutes. So it has been game changing for us.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's something that we're kind of struggling with right now, is just trying to manage schedules. And it's really so early on, but, you know, hopefully that will straighten itself out. But I would love to have a nanny.
I know. It's something to think about long term, man. You know, it's like, as especially two people running businesses, right? The idea is your schedules are going to be gnarly, and in the long run, the businesses should generate a lot of cash, right? I mean, they should turn out more money than you would probably make as a salaried employee. And with those two things in mind, it's like, all right, then we outsource as much as we can. And it's, you know, if you're still mowing your own lawn or snow blowing your own snow, I think that, honestly think that's not a good use of our time as entrepreneurs. We moved to Minneapolis, and one of the first things I did, we already had a lawn service, but I was thinking like, I'm not shoveling walks, you know, and it's not because I'm above it. I used to do it, but now like the time versus money trade-off is insane. So anyways, that's kind of my soapbox about like outsourcing stuff. And of course, I'm not talking about outsourcing someone raising my children. Of course, I know that's probably the joke or what folks are thinking, but it's like outsourcing driving them from school to the house, right? Or outsourcing just our live-in nanny, like, the kids go to bed at 8 or 8:30. And so she's hanging out in her room reading. And Sherry and I are like, well, it's 8:30. We're just going to go out for 2 hours and like have a late dinner and have drinks and talk. And you don't need to hire somebody. There's no clock running, you know, where you're paying someone $15 an hour while you're sitting down the street at a restaurant. I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690. No one ever calls us anymore.
They don't love us.
It's kind of sad. I know. We get like one call every 2 months. I tell you what, if you want us to answer, like go to the top of the queue of questions, just call it in because we get so few of them and they're fun because you get to hear the person's voice. You can remain anonymous. You don't have to say your name or your URL if you don't want to, but it's kind of nice to get those every now and again. You can also email us with questions at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, and it's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each and every episode. Although, you know what, Mike? Did you hear that our transcription service, again, this is like the fifth one we've used, they just disappeared.
Ugh.
I know. This happens like every, probably once a year. I seriously think we've been doing the podcast for 6 years, maybe? 5 or 6?
Something like that.
And I literally think we've gone through more than half a dozen of these.
Wait, are we at 7 now? 7 years?
Are we? Was it 2010?
I think so. Yeah, it was.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Dude, we are old.
I know. Our podcast is older than most businesses who listen to this.
Yeah, I know. Podcasts are older than a lot of children. Oh, all right. So anyways, transcription service. I think Josh, our editor, is looking for one right now. But it's just funny how these things just come and go. I guess it's such a commodity, you know, it's tough to stand out.
Well, I think that's the issue with all of them. And I think that's why they come and go, because it's you get the transcriptions and they go for a while and they have a really hard time raising the price because most of them tier their pricing in terms of how quickly you get it. Like, oh, if you need it in 24 hours, this is what it'll cost and it'll be some outrageous number. And then it goes down if you don't need it for like a week or so. And that's the issue, is that there's that race to the bottom in terms of getting it transcribed. And I think that most of them just can't make ends meet. And it's not just because they don't have enough business, but it's because they're not able to pay enough for those people and they just can't, the business kind of implodes at some point.
All right. So back to the outro here. Visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thank you for listening and we'll see you next time.